Hello and welcome to In the Vault, A16Z's FinTech podcast series, where we sit down with the most influential leaders in financial services. In these conversations, we offer a behind-the-scenes view of how these leaders guide and manage some of the country's most consequential companies. We also dive into the key trends impacting the industry, and of course, discuss how AI will shape the future. Today, we're joined by Goldman Sachs Chief Information Officer Marco Argenti. Marco leads the firm's global technology organization and is a member of its management committee. Prior to Goldman Sachs, Marco was a vice president of technology at AWS, where he ran several business units, including mobile, serverless compute, and augmented and virtual reality. He also spent several years at Nokia, where he was responsible for the company's developer ecosystem and app stores. In this conversation, Marco and I discuss automating workflows in financial services, turning developers into clients, and how AI is a major inflection point in the history of technology. Let's get started.
As a reminder, the content here is for informational purposes only. It should not be taken as legal, business, tax, or investment advice, or be used to evaluate any investment or security, and is not directed at any investors or potential investors in any A16Z fund. For more details, please see a16z.com/disclosures.
Yeah, Marco, thank you so much for joining. Really excited to have you here. Had the pleasure, obviously, of working with you at, during my time at Goldman.
Yeah,
I was really excited to chat with you. You've had a fascinating career, really at the forefront of a bunch of kind of technology platform shifts, right? You were a founder during the early internet, at Nokia during mobile, at AWS, obviously, during kind of the rise of the cloud, and now at Goldman, during AI. So maybe that's a good place to start. Maybe you could walk us through a bit of your career arc and, what were the kind of key learnings from each of those different periods? And perhaps how does that, inform what we're going through today?
I've been in technology pretty much all my life. I've tried different fields within technology, but it was always been, technology centered. And since I was a kid, I was, literally like, we're talking about 40 plus years ago, I was fascinated by computers. I was fascinated by the fact that you could have this impossibly malleable state machine that potentially you can get it to do whatever you wanted. And so the limit was not the machine itself, it was more like yourself and your ability to come up with stuff. And so this removal of the physical constraints. So before computers, of course, I was kind of, doing some electronics, and the frustration was you burn your fingers or you kind of burn down the house in the worst case scenario. And so all that within a computer, in a completely virtual world was something that, kind of made me dream of something bigger. I guess the internet was, I started just with regular software development doing, software of different kind. And then I started selling. I had my own startup, but then really was the internet that kind of changed everything. And as a result of that, I moved to Canada in the 90s, where I was fascinated by this idea of the kind of limitless distribution of knowledge, which is something that, by the way, is kind of something that we will reconnect when we talk about AI.
Totally.
But this idea of actually taking away the physical barrier of access to knowledge. And so I started an internet company in the 90s. We started one of the very first online stores. In fact, we launched a little bit before Amazon. And obviously, we weren't as successful. So timing was great. I don't know, something else probably wasn't. And that was relatively successful. Then we started to turn the store into an e-commerce platform, so going into B2B. And we built, also in collaboration with Microsoft, we built some of the largest online stores back then in the US. But then mobile was kind of the next obvious thing. And it was really early days. We're talking about 1999 or so. I actually moved to Europe where a friend of mine was doing an IPO of a company, and he acquired a mobile company almost like as an afterthought. And I was like, no, that's actually the most interesting part of the whole thing.
Yep.
And so I became the CEO of that company. It was called Wireless Solutions. And then we started to really kind of go down the path of mobilizing the internet, creating like infrastructure for others to create mobile websites. We did something called an SMS gateway, which was like a messaging system, and so on and so forth. Okay, but so then I went into apps. I went into kind of this idea that the mobile web was probably not rich enough for a small screen and for the experiences. So we started the first app store that I know of, like the Ovi store, which got pretty successful because of the install base. So we were doing something like 17 million downloads a day or something like that. So it was actually quite a big thing. And I guess that was one of the biggest learnings of my career, which is, again, you need to be kind of the biggest user of your own product. And the second one is that sometimes, you know, like little subtleties in user experience have a disproportionate effect. Obviously, at that time, I was dealing with a lot of app developers. Apps require a backend, and those developers were really great at doing the application on the phone. But then it was actually hard for them to do a backend, to stand up the server side of things. Sometimes apps were, you know, had literally like a server in there under their people's desk as a backend. And so this whole idea of a kind of computer on tap was so fascinating for me. And so when, you know, Amazon called me and they're like, hey, you know, want to come with us and kind of, do you want to actually start kind of the mobile services backend business within AWS, I kind of jumped at the opportunity.
Yep.
We started to go down the path of like really that the internet and compute and serverless should really be everywhere, should be really be in every object. Yep. And then, I mean, that led me to start to talk to a lot of companies that were like, for example, in manufacturing, because we were getting into IoT and supply chain, and then started to talk to CEOs about the whole idea of digital transformation, really like something that was pervasive throughout the organization. And so from that on, I started to feel this it's pretty clear that technology is really moving from kind of the back office into the center of the strategic agenda for CEOs. So I was talking, for example, to the CEO of Volkswagen or the CEOs of, Philips and other companies. Yep. And all of them, the common theme there was, we're starting to actually be limited by our technology capabilities with regards to our competitiveness. Right. And we need to really form and train a muscle and technology that is just as good as any other company, including technology company. Yep. So then I met David Solomon, at reInvent, which is like the AWS conference where he was speaking. And then we started to talk. And then, you know, it was pretty clear that Goldman had the same, vision that, especially in the world of finance, technology will play a disproportionately important role. And that, you know, that's what led me ultimately to join Goldman in 2019. So that's kind of, I know that this was a little bit long, but that's kind of the arc of about 10 minutes.
40 years and 4 minutes. That's perfect. No, it's awesome. And it's obviously, I mean, brought us to the time that we met, you know, back in 2019.
Yeah.
Maybe you can talk about kind of that transition, coming from, business like AWS and Amazon, to financial services, which I think was new for you. You know, what were some of your expectations versus reality? You know, I know you brought a very kind of, Amazon-like approach, to the firm at the time. And maybe just talk about that transition.
One of the big things when you do a transition from a tech company to, a company in a different sector is whether that sector is regulated or not. And of course, regulation is something that, can be in a way a barrier or slowing you down. And you can think about that as slowing innovation. But then kind of I learned, maybe from my control theory background, where, when I studied in university, I studied my major was on control systems, by the way, based on an early form of AI, that you can actually use controls at your own advantage to kind of gain velocity in the long term. So that was a big learning, kind of an adaptation where regulation and other controls are actually very important for sustained speed of innovation. So you might be slow at the beginning, but then eventually you will gain velocity. And so that was something that I think anybody that comes into a regulated industry has to realize. The other thing is, really like introducing, in the engineering team, the concept of kind of working backwards from the customer and really like turning it into a principle that everybody can understand. So we developed this leadership tenet for engineers, the first of which is like build with purpose. And it kind of sounds fuzzy if you talk about it, kind of, you know, sort of obvious. But really this idea that engineers, in order to be good engineers, needed to really kind of sit down with the businesses and really deeply understand the why.
Yeah.
Because engineers, they tend to start from the how.
Yeah.
So if you get a bunch of engineers, in a room, like, you know, for example, if they need to do a web project, you can count the seconds before the discussion on frameworks come up, right? And maybe not, that's a good discussion, but not the discussion I would start from.
Sure.
And so this idea of kind of saying, okay, you know, we need to ask ourselves fundamental questions. Who's the client? And really, you know, what is the problem or the opportunity that we're trying to solve? And then how do we measure that? How do we know that that's actually something that the client will like? Those questions, and then having them written into narratives, it kind of fundamentally started to change the culture, because engineers tended to kind of get really fuzzy requirements from the businesses, and then kind of, you know, go into sort of a series of approximation. Whereas this idea of shifting left and actually writing down a plan that is very solid that any business person can understand,
mm-hmm.
before you write the first line of code. And so this idea of introducing the concept of platforms was extremely important, and really to kind of, you know, speed us up. And now again, fast forwarding, we have about 10 of them firm-wide, like there are heavily adopted, like cloud platform, the data platform, or the identity and access management platforms, the API platform, mobile platform, and so forth,
yep.
that developers can just build on top of that.
And I think yeah. I recall that being actually a really important kind of message, I feel like, that you brought to the firm, which was, you know, we're going to make the developer our client. You know, and I think it was kind of one of the first times that Goldman's
That's
began
right.
thinking about the developer as the client. It was always a corporate, an individual, an institution. And I think that it was developers internally within the organization, within other divisions, you know, kind of leveraging, as you're describing, kind of platforms built in core engineering. But it's also developers at other companies who can build, you know, kind of embed Goldman's capabilities into their distribution or into
yeah.
their workflows. Maybe talk a little bit about that kind of shift.
Yeah, and that was definitely a new. It's the same thing. Remember when I said that you kind of need to understand as a leader what your clients are thinking by kind of trying your own product. And I think also today, given the importance of developers, I think it's also a responsibility of a leader, not only a technologist, to try to really understand what developers are thinking and what they want and how they think and meet them where they are, externally and internally, because sometimes even externally in your clients, the decision makers are not only the business people, but are also like the choice of technology and which leads then to the choice of a service is done by developers.
Totally.
And so you really need to think of them as decision makers, even when you're dealing with an external client. And we're seeing that more and more every day. And of course, you know, some of our clients are kind of more like that. Like, for example, some of the hedge funds or some of the quant funds, as you know, I mean, you know it really, really well that, you know, we're talking to the technologists is just as important as talking to the business people.
Yep.
And then you kind of, there is a little bit of a spectrum there. But I think really back to the idea that really the role of technologists have really changed dramatically, not only in the internal dynamics, but also in the way you actually do business.
Totally. I guess to that point, you know, another, I feel like, shift that has happened. And I feel like it was happening while I was there, and I'm sure it's even only accelerated, was kind of this willingness to adopt third-party technology. I think Goldman, you know, famously had built a lot of internal systems. I think
yeah.
I remember, you know, folks talking about the kind of word processing system the firm had built in the 90s or an email client. But I feel like, you know, I mean, you very much understood what it meant to be a platform. Obviously, AWS was a platform that other people built on. I guess, how do you today, you know, think about leveraging internal engineering resources in terms of building software? How do you decide what you need to build internally versus what you're willing to partner with third-party companies or, you know, buy software? Like, how do you sort of reconcile that decision for what needs to be owned and built in-house versus leverage from the outside?
Yeah, so at the very beginning, we kind of introduced our digital strategy tenets, if you remember, and one of them was look outside first before you build. Just because, you know, you have a bunch of smart people, you don't necessarily need to build everything. And I think to me, the kind of the acid test is where do I actually want to employ, like, the my best people and my best resources into which kind of tasks? And is that something that will create some form of competitive differentiation or, you know, contribute to the growth of the business, etc.? If it is commodity, if the problem is already being solved by someone else, there isn't really a good argument to actually build it yourself. And also, like, it doesn't just apply to vendor software, it applies to open source in general. Obviously, like, open source is an incredible wealth of intellectual property, where, you know, there is tens of thousands or millions of people that have actually spent, you know, hundreds of millions of hours in kind of figuring out some of the most difficult problems. And so kind of really like asking that question first, which is, okay, what is out there that could actually give us this functionality? And then, of course, you go into a very rigorous selection process because you need to make sure that the solution is widely adopted, that it's supported, that it's safe, that it's secured, et cetera, et cetera. And so in many cases, you know, like we decide to use a vendor or we decide to use open source, and then we build a kind of, you know, like, let's say a scaffolding around it to make sure that A, it integrates with our systems and with our data, B, you know, it operates in a compliant and safe and secure way. But then at the core, the functionality, it's something that you can, you know, you can kind of leverage to make sure that you're kind of removing this undifferentiated heavy lifting in a way and really focus on things that are accretive to your business. Open source is, you know, something that, of course, you need to be careful about. You need to be extremely selective, but it can actually help a lot, you know, in kind of, I would say, put your priorities or your capital, you know, human capital in the things that really matter.
Totally.
And instead of reinventing the wheel. But it's also something that actually motivates developers, especially when you create an open source project for others.
Well, I want to shift gears a little bit because, you know, it feels like we are entering a new platform shift, you know, with AI. And I'm curious, you know, how are you thinking about, you know, generative AI? What are you guys already doing with it? And maybe, you know, we can kind of imagine the future forward and think about how it may impact, you know, kind of financial services or Goldman specifically.
I would start by saying that despite all the skepticism that I try to apply and trying to suspend, like, suspension of belief in this case, but I'm pretty profoundly convinced that at this point that we really kind of hit a major inflection point in technology that has really profound impact. There are societal impact and business impact, probably like you know, and again, in my history of this 40 years, 4 minutes, probably bigger than any of the revolutions that I've seen. Also because of how quickly that almost became almost like an essential tool for everyday's life for a lot of people that I know, including myself and my daughter. There was a time in which in order to study a subject, I needed to physically go to a library. And then it was like, you know, it took me hours before I could actually read something. If I didn't understand the subject deeply enough, I kind of had to match myself to the right book, which was, like, you know, not easy, and then climb this ladder of knowledge until I was finally equipped to understand a certain subject. Physical barrier removed, but knowledge barrier was still there. From, you know, the age of Gutenberg to now, hasn't really changed. It has changed now. That's why I kind of sometimes compare the invention of AI to the invention of the printing press in a way that it removed a major barrier. First one was a physical barrier. This one is a knowledge barrier. Your prompt most often determines your level of knowledge, and the AI actually explains things to you that are attuned to that level of knowledge. And then you can kind of climb that ladder by asking more and more questions, and interactively, you know, the AI will kind of get you deeper and deeper into a subject. It's almost like having a personal tutor that can be available now to billions of people, which is kind of unprecedented. And I think that will have profound repercussions on the way we kind of shape the education system and the way we shape, you know, just the access to knowledge, but also how quickly you can ramp up and become proficient, you know, in your own job. When it comes to impact on the business, I kind of tend to think about that, and also kind of the way we think about it in Goldman, like as a sort of a spectrum where you know, on the left side, which is kind of the more immediate opportunity, mm-hmm. is kind of the impact on productivity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that could be pretty, you know, pretty significant, possibly one of the potentially more significant productivity enhancements that we've seen. And then you kind of walk the spectrum all the way on the right side, where you have more like, you know, sort of alpha generating or growth generating use cases, which might not return on investment right away, because you actually might need to train your AI, you might need to, you know, make it really like understand your business, and will require investment. And so as we navigate that spectrum, first of all, one of the things that I was really kind of, and I am really kind of keen on is, hey, this is something really new that we profoundly do not understand. Nobody really understands AI profoundly yet. The things that we don't know are probably more than the things that we know. And so we need to kind of sandbox that into an environment that will allow us for safe innovation and safe experimentation. We mandate that everything that we do is starts from understanding the why and starts to understand. So we have set up you know, a working group or a committee that kind of reviews all the ideas. And we selected out of hundreds of ideas, we've selected about 15 or 19 actually at this point that were kind of, you know, at different phases of piloting. I think the very first thing that we're actually starting to be using AI at scale is developer productivity, back to developers, right?
Yep.
And we're seeing the developer productivity go up, you know, can be anywhere from 10 to 40%, depending on the developer, depending on the use case, which is massive, even if it stays at 10%. But then also it has a direct impact on developer happiness, which, by the way, you and I know that it is one of the most important factors for productivity, because a happy developer that is in the wave, that is in the zone, actually is, you know, like 10x, you know, like the famous 10x productivity gain is pretty well understood. And then, of course, it's a journey, because at the beginning you implement tools that are kind of generic, but then you start, you know, adapting the whatever copilot type of AI you're using for your developers with institutional knowledge.
I think that's like it's an interesting point, because, you know, I mean, first of all, people, you know, may not know or forget that, you know, Goldman has, I don't know, a 10,000 plus, you know, engineering organization. So it's, you know, a pretty material percentage of the overall, you know, headcount of the company. So even just, you know, the 10 to 40% impact on productivity, you know, can have a significant impact on,
for sure,
on bottom line.
But then you can extend that to how many of our 45,000 are actually people that are in the knowledge business. I mean, and so most of them, right? And so then when you started expanding to that, to bankers, to investors, you know, to personal, you know, like to private wealth managers, you know, and then even eventually to registered investment advisors. So that knowledge, it's so powerful, because it really changes, at the end of the day, it changes not only the, you know, your own productivity, but also your dynamics with your clients. And then eventually will actually become the new normal in the way actually clients expect to deal with you, and actually can create the competitive differentiation on the way we actually create products and make decisions and create strategies and so on and so forth.
If we kind of, you know, imagine kind of into the future, I'm curious what you think AI's impact might be on, you know, financial services as an industry, you know, maybe 10 to 15 years from now.
You know, it's funny, because this is one of those things in which it's even hard to predict the next 6 months, right? with the speed that things that are evolving, and there are like really still very big open questions right now. First of all, it will be a sort of a table shifting type of phenomenon, where you know, it will create new leaders. It will reinforce a position of some of the leaders that are actually able to kind of be at the forefront of this and be able to leverage that in the proper way. So I think it will create differentiation for sure. I think, you know, one trend in financial services has been that, speed is becoming more and more of a factor. Price is important, but how quickly you can price is also, you know, very important, especially with some classes of clients. And the switch from batch to real time, and more like having a real time business where you need to make decisions really fast, that you need to settle really quickly, that you know, you need to go through front to back extremely quickly. That and so all that, I think this shift towards more of a real time business is something that AI definitely will accelerate. The ability to have very complex models of the world and of the economy, I think the relationship with clients will change. And as I said before, the expectation of clients of you being extremely good at providing personalized advice, personalized portfolios, understanding deeply what are the repercussions of certain events in your investment strategy, and being able to kind of provide that kind of information at a speed and at a quality, a level of quality that is probably unprecedented.
Anything we didn't touch on that, that you wanted to, you know, kind of discuss before we end?
I think back to what we quickly talked about, you know, like some of the big open questions. I think one of the most interesting, fascinating questions right now is how to kind of navigate. I have open source models that might be maybe less capable in a way, but could have advantages such as, you know, they can run on premise or they can be fine tuned. Etc. Or, you know, do I rely on, you know, benchmark performance or reasoning capabilities or emerging abilities are kind of the most important things. And that do I rely on large proprietary models? And I think that's one of the big strategic questions that every CIO needs to face today when kind of adopting an AI strategy.
I'm very curious. And also if you're fine tuning on your own kind of corpus of data, but yes, I'm curious your perspective between some of these large kind of closed models versus maybe open source.
Probably nobody beats those large models with regards to actually reasoning capabilities, okay? But then there is a lot of specialized knowledge where you need to somehow tune the model, and it doesn't matter if it is pre-training or if it is fine-tuning or if it is RAG, but you kind of have to bias the model somehow. And then, you know, you can think of a future where you're almost going to have, I kind of call it hybrid AI. It's kind of the same way as the world of the cloud evolved, where you know every company at the end of the day has a part of their workloads in the cloud, where you leverage elasticity, agility, and scalability. But then you also have on-premise low workloads, which might be necessary for latency purposes, sometimes for data sovereignty purposes, or for whatever other purpose you might find relevant. And I think the same is going to be with AI, where you're going to have a reliance on large proprietary models, mostly for the reasoning capabilities, almost like, I really want to understand what you're asking. Mm-hmm. And then kind of they will generate and they will orchestrate a set of smaller models, which have been trained and highly specialized on specific tasks, your neuron data on, like if you have like we do an internal language, which is slang, train it on that, or your own knowledge base or your own institutional knowledge, your own environment. And then, or perform a specialized calculation, like, I don't know, calculating an efficient frontier or whatever that might be. And then they return, highly accurate results back to more like the general reasoning AI, which then does a fantastic job of summarizing it for whatever purpose you want. Almost like a constellation of planets and satellites. Mm-hmm.
Marco, thank you so much for the time. Always a pleasure.
David, thank you so much.
I got to go to your next concert here in New York City. For those that don't know, Marco has a great grunge band. So not only is he an amazing CIO, he's also an amazing guitarist. And just really appreciate the time and always a pleasure.
Thank you so much, David. Thank you for having me.
I'd like to thank our guests for joining In the Vault. You can hear all of our episodes by going to a16z.com/podcasts. To learn more about the latest in fintech news, be sure to visit a16z.com/fintech and subscribe to our monthly fintech newsletter. Thanks for tuning in.